You are listening to Independence West on VOA.
We're going to talk about South Korean cinema and about current tensions on the Korean Peninsula. We're going to talk about the way an elite runner confronts tragedy in the wake of this week's events in Boston. And we're going to talk about the immigration reform bill under consideration in the U.S. Senate. We got François Sou in the production booth. Rohit Kulkarni has a crazy day at the VOA South Asia division, so he can't join us today. And Roger Muntu, of course, is fashionably late, but by rule, he has to be fashionably late. He has to be 10 minutes late to this program. It's an Independence West rule and exclusive. We voted on it last week. I'm Robert D. here in Studio 41 at Voice of America, and you are listening to ID West. In a couple of minutes, we're going to be talking to Kyu Hyun Kim, who teaches Korean culture at the University of California, Davis, and who's an expert on Korean cinema. So, France, I've got to tell you, my initial reason for wanting to talk about Korean cinema was because recent tensions got me to think about a South Korean movie that came out last year, and it's called The Spies. And it's the story of a group of North Korean sleeper agents who live in the South and who are reactivated somewhat against their will. Now, that movie sounded fascinating to me at first. While I was looking for guests, I ended up getting in touch with Professor Kim, who told me, by the way, in an email, he hadn't seen the movie The Spies, but he told me the movie had gotten pretty bad reviews in Korea. However, he said there are so many other movies we can talk about that explore the relationship between the North and the South and talk about peninsula tensions. And I also get the sense South Korean cinema is really dynamic and it's only now really beginning to get international recognition, at least here in the West. Thanks to new media, thanks to online movie rental sites like Netflix here in the United States, that sort of things. Professor Kim in California, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And thank you for joining us. First of all, am I right? I mean, is South Korean cinema really beginning to get recognition here in the United States, maybe that it did not enjoy before?
Yes, I think that's correct. And it depends, of course, on how recent is recent. So I think for the connoisseurs, maybe since about 2003 or so, I think 2003, it has been a quite well known that Korean cinema had, certain kind of fascination for the people who are in the industry and also in critical community. But I think that the Korean TV drama and Korean movies have been extremely popular since then. And now I think that it's perhaps making inroads into the popular consciousness in the way Japanese animation has done, which I believe has become completely mainstream in America.
I spoke to you when we, originally got in touch with one another about, the movie The Spies.
Yes.
And it really sounded fascinating to me, at least reading about it on paper, because it got reviewed in this on this website called beyondhollywood.com. There is this reviewer called James Mudge, a Briton, but who's an expert on Asian cinema. And he really made it sound interesting in his review. And you told me, if anything, it's gotten bad reviews in Korea.
Yeah, well, actually, I didn't mean to suggest that, people who are, stars like Kim Young-min, which is a major star, and the box office records probably would not have been that bad. So I'm really talking about the critical response in the way, like journalists write about it.
Of course.
The thing is that the main hook up the movie, which is about North Korean sleeper agents in South Korea, that idea has been tried many times in other movies. So it's actually one of the issues that South Koreans are always thinking about since at least 2000. I think there was a movie in 1999, if I remember correctly, called Spy Lee Chul-jin, which is a comedy, by the way. It's about North Korean agent who is sent to South Korea, and he gets robbed by a South Korean thugs, and he loses all of his weapons and so on. and he has to rely on his fellow agents, and his fellow agents has been living in South Korea for so long. They have been completely incorporated into South Korean culture. So their children go to schools, they have a regular business, and the North Koreans send this kind of do this and do that messages, and then they are quite unhappy about it. And there's another good movie called Secret Reunion, which is a much more serious violent thriller, and it also features a North Korean agent who has lived in South Korea for many years and is having a major problem following orders from the North Korea when he suddenly sends them this message to go out and assassinate somebody.
Now, before I go on to thrillers,
yes.
You're talking about a divided country, a country that's been divided for more than 60 years now,
yes.
Divided families, everything, you know, political tensions, demilitarized zone, whatever.
Yes.
But you know, you talked about comedies as a way of dealing with the division of Korea. I get the sense, and maybe I'm wrong,
mm-hmm.
that Korean directors would be very careful in the way they tread that issue, meaning they would be very careful about, anything that could be seen, for example, as making fun, say, of northern leaders. You know, am I wrong? It's just I'm not an expert by any means on the Korean peninsula, Korean culture, but it's just the vibe that I get whenever I get, I see a report on North Korea or a feature on relations between the two governments, these sorts of things. Am I wrong?
Right. I mean, there are areas where the South Koreans are more sensitive and are more careful about. And there are areas where they feel much freer to talk about things, meaning that there can be more wider ranges of response to what North Korea. It, I mean, actually, the South Korean image of North Korea is a kind of fascinating thing, and it evolves over the time. It certainly has evolved completely in many, many different directions in my lifetime. When I was growing up in Korea, of course, it was very, very Cold War framework. Cold War framework was extremely powerful, and North Korea was certainly seen as an extremely repressive society. And there was a sharp dichotomy of views about of them as the North Koreans as a kind of object of pity, as opposed to people who was very violent and villains in a James Bond movie kind of thing. But I think that attitude has changed in the last 10 years. Now we have a much more complex view of North Koreans, and I think this is also affected by the fact that there are now a lot of North Korean refugees, thousands of North Korean refugees in Korea living today. So they are, if anything, become like ethnic minorities in American society.
Well, that's another point.
Yeah.
To what extent do Roger, you can come in. Thank you. Roger is wonderful. I have to tell you, Professor Kim, we have a rule here on ID West. He can only show up in the studio 10 minutes late. So he just showed up with his beautiful Burberry shirt and all that. So while Roger is setting up, I was hearing a fascinating feature on Swiss-German radio a few weeks ago about just how much trouble North Korean refugees in the South can face sometimes. For example, there was the case of this individual who was training to become a police officer, and to actually make it through the entrance exam to the police academy. And I think for the fifth or sixth time, he had been rejected. And there are terrible, terrible integration problems as far as they are concerned.
Yes, there is a terrible integration problem. And I think that has the flip side of this really a severe Cold War view of North Korea as the evil regime. Flip side of that was sort of the romanticism about how the Koreans, when they're liberated from the yokes of this ideology, would just embrace together and then live happily ever after. And nowadays in Korea, I think the younger generation especially is largely disabused of this this notion. They really are seeing these things with a clearer eyes, and then they recognize that there are a lot of practical problems they have to deal with.
I want to go on to thrillers now.
Yes.
First of all, there is another movie that came out last year, and that's called The Thieves. And I'm explaining it to Roger. You know, that's why I'm looking at him right now. It's basically a movie about a South Korean gangster crew mm-hmm. that teams up with a Hong Kong crew mm-hmm. to rob a Macau casino.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Macau is this big, you know, casino hub.
Right.
And, you know, that's another movie that I would like to see because what little information I got on it really made it sound interesting.
What made it sound interesting?
Well, it's sort of like a South Korean version of Ocean's 11. Professor Kim, have you had a chance to see it?
Yes, I did see it,
Wow.
it's a very good movie. And the director Choi Byung-hun, his production company is actually called Caper Films. So he actually specializes in the caper films, as we understand. So it's really remarkable that in South Korea now there is such a diversity of filmmakers. So we have people who sort of take on this subgenre of American movie making or European movie making, and then they just consistently make movies you know, in that subgenre. And Choi Dong-won has been extremely successful. He made an adaptation of an extremely popular Korean comic book called Tatsa,
yeah.
The High Rollers, and that has been extremely popular in Korea. And the Thieves should be seen as an extension of this. It's sort of like internationally expanded version of that.
Well, to what extent do you think also Hong Kong gangster movies might have influenced the new generation of South Korean filmmakers? Because Hong Kong has such a huge and lively movie industry, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
It has been tremendously influential. But it also is very interesting now that Korean cinema industry is doing so well. They are actually now in a position to, you know, get, in terms of financing the movies, they get actively involved with other Asian film industries. And I think that's actually been, you know, there is a historical precedent to it. I mean, there were a lot of sort of cross-pollination between Korean and the Hong Kong film industries in 1960s up to 70s. But, you know, it never made into the... I mean, when Koreans are watching these martial arts movies ostensibly made in Korea, in fact, it had a lot of Hong Kong crews and the actors and the martial arts experts in the movie, and including Jackie Chan, by the way. I recently saw an interview with Jackie Chan, and he spoke this, good Korean, basically. He said he dated a Korean woman, and he lived in Korea in 70s when he was being an extra in a Bruce Lee movies and so on. He actually lived in Korea for quite a while.
Well, Jackie Chan is now an American. So
he's invested so much time into the U.S. That's true. But the guy is amazing. I mean, we're going on a bit of a tangent here. You know, he actually made a movie with Shilpa Shetty, also the big Indian star. The guy really invests
mm-hmm.
his time
where
the movie markets
Definitely.
Are. You
right.
know, unbelievable mm-hmm. business acumen. One last thing, Professor Kim. I planned this segment in part because I wanted to learn from an expert what Korean movies to see. I haven't seen very many. There's one movie that I saw last year online, excellent movie, very harsh movie, The Chaser by Na Hong Jim.
Yes.
That is a harsh movie, don't you think?
Yes, it is. But his newest movie, The Yellow Sea, is the worst.
I heard about that. I heard about that. Yeah, it's going to be shown at Cannes, won't it? Well, was it June last year?
It probably will be available in Netflix now. I think it's been going around for a while.
But I think it was shown at the Cannes Film Festival last year.
Yeah,
but
there are several versions of it, and I think the shorter version is better.
Yeah?
The longer version is just too much. It's kind of it sort of wears the viewers out with the... There's too much grim stuff about... basically, it's still about the... how the mainstream Korean society treats the people who lived in China and then come back and so on. So it is politically relevant, but I think it's definitely not for the American mainstream taste.
Now, Françoise Hsu wants to ask you a question in a bit, but before she does, I've got to explain to everybody what The Chaser is.
That's what I was going to ask. Chaser, I want to know more about The Chaser.
Now, you can see it on Netflix here in the States.
Is it on Netflix?
It is.
Okay.
But it's the story of a Korean, South Korean pimp who starts losing his women to an unknown person. And he sends one of his women to a customer who, you know, makes an appointment by phone. And the customer kidnaps her. You soon discover he's a sort of serial killer.
Ooh.
Meanwhile, the police arrest the suspect. They can't, you know, discover a body. Mm-hmm. They can't hold him more than 12 hours because of lack of evidence.
Right.
And so you have this sort of chase that goes on for 2 or 3 days and nights around Seoul. And again, it's a very, very gritty,
harsh
movie.
How long is the movie?
A little over 2 hours.
Wow.
But I'm telling you, it's nonstop tension, nonstop action. And again, it's a very, very dark movie.
Did you like it, though, overall?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I thought it was an excellent movie.
Okay.
You know, it's the sort of movie they might turn into a remake here in the United States. Mm-hmm. Don't you think, Professor Kim?
Yes.
Yeah.
Except that that movie is very locally bound in Korean society. It sort of exposes sort of dark side of Korean society. And it's much more powerful for Koreans. And I think Hollywood would have to change the part where, the basically police fails to save certain characters at the end.
Okay.
And, yeah.
That's a good point.
Those things happen. will be very tough to take
to
the Hollywood filmmakers.
That's right.
Now, Françoise Hsu wanted to ask you something, Professor Kim.
Yes.
Okay, so she wants to know whether, Japanese manga comics are also manhwa, are also really popular in Korea?
Yes, they are very popular. They also went through a very interesting series of evolution. There was a time when Korean manhwa was entirely under the thumb of manga. So almost all the great manga, the manhwa that I have read when I was growing up was based on Japanese manga. But that has completely changed. Ironically, since Korea has opened up their the market for Japanese manga, and then they came in. And in fact, since then, they have just incorporated the Japanese influence and then begin to go in new direction. Now we have manga artists like Kang Fu, whose manhwa is in fact based on internet format.
Now, France has one last question before we go out.
Okay.
So she wants to know whether they turn manhwa into movies and whether those are popular when they do so, if they do so.
Oh, yes, absolutely. There is a very, very strong genre relationship between successful manhwa and the movies. In fact, Kang Fu, the one I just mentioned, I think almost all of his major manhwa was being adapted into movies. And, of course, Koreans adapt Japanese manga, too, nowadays. They actually buy the most famous example, of course, is Old Boy, directed by Park Chan-wook.
Okay. Well, listen, Professor Kim, thank you very much
thank
for
you.
Taking the time to talk to us about movies, about manhwa, about manga, about popular culture, about peninsular tensions. I'm telling you, I'm going to be watching a lot of Korean movies.
Me too.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Absolutely. And Professor, let's do it again before too long. Thank you. Take good
thank
care.
You. Bye.
Bye-bye. You're listening to ID West. I'm Robert D. In a couple of minutes, we're going to be talking to Steve Taylor, who's a certified elite runner here in the U.S. and who's run several marathons, including twice, I believe, the race in Boston where the bombings occurred earlier this week. The original idea for this segment was to talk about football, about the up-and-coming French club Paris Saint-Germain, and the possible arrival there of Wayne Rooney of Manchester United. But a couple of things happened this week. First of all, Paris Saint-Germain have been playing down the possibility of a Rooney transfer. The coach, Ancelotti, even said, you know, PSG could never afford someone of his caliber like the English striker. Second, a colleague told me after the Boston bombings, dude, this is a no-brainer. You should be talking to a runner. That would be the obvious sports segment for this week. So we're going to talk to Steve Taylor. He was referred to me by a very dear old friend of mine who also likes to run marathons. Good afternoon, Steve Taylor.
Hello, Robert. Thanks for having me on the show.
And thanks for having me. First of all, what's a certified elite runner? Because I think that's the expression that you used when we first spoke on the phone on Wednesday.
Well, you actually have a combination of terms there. I would be considered an elite runner, although I'm a bit past my prime because I have a one-year-old son now. But I competed in an elite level. I sometimes would win running races, or I would run results or times that would have me placed in a very competitive division in some of the larger races, perhaps winning first in my age division. Now, the certified piece is that I have training and credentials as a running coach, and I've done that for about 15 years, and during that time I have coached several hundred runners who are beginners, out-of-shape people who are new to the sport of competitive running and fitness running, and then also a good number of people who are, a bit stronger and closer to the elite category.
Now, how old are you, if you don't mind my asking?
I am 38 years old.
Okay. And how many marathons have you run?
Well, I've ran probably somewhere around 20 or 25 standalone marathons, but I've also run many races which are longer than the marathon distance, which is 26 miles, or I've done some translations to kilometers, since I think some of your audience may think in those terms, 42 kilometers for a marathon, but I've also run races of 50 to 100 miles and also 80 to 160 kilometers. And then there's a related sport of triathlon, which includes swimming and biking, along with running.
Of course.
Where I've run marathons as well, but that's a topic for another day.
Now, let me go on a quick tangent. And by the way, Françoise, who is prostrating herself, you know, in front of the mic because she so admires, you know, all the effort that you've made and all that sort of things. But in triathlon, is the Ironman still considered sort of the gold standard?
That's right. It will be actually very comparable to say that in running, the marathon would be comparable to the Ironman in triathlon. And in fact, an Ironman triathlon has a marathon as the third leg.
Now, a marathon is a huge commitment. In what way does what happened in Boston on Monday affect your resolve as a runner?
Well, I think, personally, I've run so many races that I'm in the twilight of my elite days as a runner, but it certainly, I remain committed to the sport of running, and in fact, maybe a slight increase in my result to run Boston Marathon again as an act of defiance. But I think, the sport is popular, and I think it may cause people to be just a little bit more aware to our vulnerability in everyday life, including in doing these sports. But I don't predict that it will, in the slightest, decrease participation in running events.
Now, of course, I want to make clear the point of this segment, the point of this conversation, is not to talk about the Boston bombings per se, because there are other shows at VOA and elsewhere that can do that in much greater depth. So that's not the point. But nonetheless, it's obvious that we can talk about the way in which a runner confronts tragedy or perhaps finds meaning in a tragedy. And when we spoke on the phone on Wednesday, you told me a story, a very interesting story, about the precise spot where the first bomb went off on Monday.
Sure. Well, this is a little bit in my history of my running towards the beginning of my elite career. And when I first qualified for the Boston Marathon, and I can talk more about that process in a moment, but my whole family traveled to Boston to watch me run the marathon. And they celebrated with me and were excited to watch me participating and finishing. And when I talked to my father, he said, you know what? We were standing in the exact spot watching you finish where that bomb exploded. And the story that's really significant is not only was that part of my experience and my family's experience, the very next night after participating in this event in Boston, my family drove to New York, and we actually went up in the World Trade Center. And as a family, we visited that landmark. And so it's interesting that now that trip and that wonderful memory for me, two historic tragedies were tied to that one weekend.
Now, I understand through our common friend, Stephen, that you are also training for the priesthood at the moment. Find spiritual meaning in all that you've just told me?
Well, I think that there's an optimism, there's a faith that's common, both in a vivid spiritual life, whatever faith a person happens to practice when they engage in that with diligence, the same as a rigorous fitness training program, a competitive program. And so if your goal is to qualify for the Boston Marathon or the London Marathon, that takes really a concerted effort that really covers almost every aspect of your life. And I think spiritually the thing that draws me to seminary I am right now is the same, that dedicating yourself to something that's larger than you are and that it takes your entire being to pursue.
Have you already run the London Marathon? I'm asking that because London is going to be run this coming Sunday.
Well, I did a little bit of research on the London Marathon since you mentioned that. I have not run the London Marathon, but I did notice that there is some similarities with Boston. Boston is the oldest marathon in this country, and it's the most well-known, probably along with New York, and London would be in a very similar category in terms of most famous marathons in the world. Another commonality is that both for Boston and London, to automatically be able to enter, there's a very rigorous qualification standard. So to run the Boston Marathon, to qualify for an under 40 male, you have to run faster than a 3:05 marathon, 3 hours and 5 minutes, and that would be at a pace of 4:23 per kilometer. For a female, it would be under 3 hours and 40 minutes, and that would be 5:05 per kilometer. And the times are very similar for London to enter that race.
Now, François Sou, who's our producer, wanted to ask you something. So France was asking whether, for a non-competitive runner, finishing the race is more important or, ranking highly.
Well, to run a marathon, from the average person, running for 3 hours sounds almost overwhelming, or 4 or 5 hours. And for anyone to finish a marathon run is a huge accomplishment. With that being said, for anyone, that would be a huge accomplishment. A lot of the people that I've trained and worked with as a coach, for them to finish any marathon, big deal. But the idea to qualify for the Boston Marathon is such a high ideal, such a special achievement, that it's really an achievement of a lifetime. And again, to speak to your associate's question specifically, most people do these kind of races just to finish and to feel great about participating, to hang the medal around their neck and to put it on the wall. And it's a very small subset that really takes seriously how fast can I finish the race, because there might be tens of thousands of participants. It's a very small number that are ever going to consider the opportunity to win a race like that.
You know, I have to say, I'm a little older than you are, and it astonishes me how many people in my age group have actually begun running marathons. Is it something that you've noticed also, you know, as you move into your 30s, mid-30s, more of your friends who might not have been runners earlier began training for marathons, that sort of things?
Oh, certainly. The 40-year-olds and 50-year-olds and even older, it's real popular to start this activity. And, you know, none of us are getting younger. So people, as they
Except
age
Roger
a little
Muntu.
Bit, they realize I better do something, you know, to keep my health.
That's right.
And to keep my energy up. Mm-hmm. And running is a great activity. All the stamina, endurance type sports are great for that. So I've made a very good living coaching people that want to get into these activities
right.
at a later age, and they're not sure how to begin, and I can help bring them along safely.
Now, can you also coach us? I'm sorry, Steve. My name is Roger. I'm the co-host of ID West with Robert here.
Hi, Roger.
How are you doing? It's great
I'm
to have
you. I'm doing well. Thank you.
Perfect. It's an honor to have you, Steve. It's great. I mean, all the information that you've given us here, it's great. It's excellent.
Thank you.
But I have a few questions, Steve. You know, after what we saw in Boston, you know, can you really say that hero really exists, the heroes? I mean, after what we saw that people were going to, running toward, instead of running to finish the race, well, you know, some start just running, running to save their lives, you know, for that sake. But they were running to save lives. And can you really now, I mean, can you say that heroes really exist?
Well, both as an athlete, and as a person of faith, I think the hero is the dominant narrative and the victorious narrative. And that is, we saw people, you know, like you said, running, you know, as soon as the smoke hadn't even cleared and there were first response, and it wasn't only the medical people.
Exactly. And that's
some
my
of the
point.
Runners from the race were running over there. And so, you know, and if there's going to be a place where people need medical help, a running race is a very good place to do that, because there tend to be a lot of nurses and doctors.
Right. We saw that, too. That's right, Steve. And also, Steve, you said earlier that you don't think that the Boston tragedy will affect, marathon. But we have one coming on Sunday in London. Isn't it Sunday? That's right.
That is correct,
yeah. Don't you think that that's a little bit too soon and that might still be in people's mind and might affect, you know, whoever's going to show up there?
Well, I remember still very vividly after 9/11, and part of the reason I remember it so vividly was that on September 8th of 2001, I did my first Ironman triathlon. I did that race, and I actually had a very good day, and I won the race that day. And I was certainly grateful that this tragedy had happened right after that, because everything kind of came to a halt immediately after 9/11. Everything did. But I remember watching on television the Hawaii Ironman, which was in early October, and we had already gotten back to a normal routine, and, you know, it was an act of defiance. It was a heroic act to go back to our normal routine. And I think that ultimately the people that intend to terrorize, we will go back. Now, I have every doubt after the London Olympics this summer were uneventful in a good way. I have no doubt that the officials in London are going to be on a heightened alert. And, you know, we pray that nothing happens.
Right.
But I think it's better for all of those concerned to go ahead with
right.
it. You know, we had another crazy event. The New York Marathon just this year was canceled at the last minute. This hurricane was here.
Right, exactly.
So
exactly.
I think you have to evaluate it at the moment. I think unless there's a credible threat, I think they should go with it in London.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, listen, Steve, thank you very much for taking a few minutes to speak to us, and best success in everything you do, all your endeavors, you know, running, you know, your
Robert,
spiritual endeavors.
Can I just add one
please
more?
Do. Please do. Please, 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 please.
A friend of mine who's a writer, and he writes on a website called the logicoflongdistance.com. It's logicoflongdistance.com.
Noted.
And he says, a bomb is the opposite of a marathon.
Mm-hmm.
In a marathon, you hurt yourself to improve. With a bomb, someone is hurting others to destroy.
Wow.
And if there's one thing that I could leave your listeners with thinking about is, let's all focus on when we have to make sacrifices, when we have to be the hero in our own life for others. Let's sacrifice ourselves to improve everything, instead of hurting others to destroy.
Well, we leave our listeners with that comment, that quote. Once again, thank you, Steve, and I hope we get a chance to talk again someday soon.
Thank you so much, Robert. My pleasure.
All right, take care. You're listening to ID West. I'm Robert D.
Drinking a German beer with a Cuban cigar, in the middle of Paris with a Dominican bar, great head on her shoulder, she probably studied abroad, she transferred to Harvard from King's College in Martin, she says that I'm her favorite cause she admires the art, Michelangelo with the flow, Picasso with the bar, she's well put together like a piece by Gershwin, Renaissance style, tonight is picture perfect, so smile, and pack your bags real good baby, cause you'll be gone for a while, wow, wow. From Norway to Egypt, hey. I'm to the point like the pyramids of Giza. Still I'm to the left like the tower out in Pisa. I'm feeling single, baby, I could use a feature, hey. Swagger like Caesar, hey. I'll get you a visa, hey. We can go to Italy and maybe see the Colosseum, yeah. I'll be Da Vinci if you be my Mona Lisa. And I smile, so pack your bags real good, baby, cause you'll be gone for a while. Spin the globe, wherever it lands, that's where we'll go. We'll hit up Europe, yeah, and spend some euros. Or maybe visit Berlin, the walls with the murals. This is your month, baby, sign of the Virgo. Private reservations, glasses full of Merlot. A rosé, a burgundy, traveling like turbo. Brush up on your Espanol, we're Barcelona bound for smile. So pack your bags real good, baby, cause you'll be gone for a while. Wow, wow.
In just a minute, we're going to be talking to Elise Foley, who covers politics and immigration for the Huffington Post, the big online magazine here in the United States. There's been a lot of talk the past few weeks about pending legislation. In fact, there has been a breakthrough in recent days, a compromise legislation being worked out by a group of senators here in Washington that would allow most of the estimated 11 or so million undocumented foreigners in the United States to acquire legal residency and to gain eventual citizenship, a bill that also mandates tougher law enforcement and greater border surveillance. Elise Foley, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It's so good to have you at long last. I mean, we've been Twitter friends or followers or whatever for I don't know how long, but tell me one thing. What is the significance of this bill for a variety of actors, beginning with President Obama?
You know, it's really significant. I think especially now, yesterday there were a bunch of votes on gun control legislation, which he's made kind of a central part of his second term.
Since the Newtown shootings, of course.
Guns and immigration have been kind of his two things, and yesterday the gun part sort of went down in flames, and so I think immigration now is especially important for him to get done. He's made the promise just over and over that he's going to get something passed, and so it's really important, you know, for him to have something like this come together and then to, you know, eventually he hopes to be able to do it.
Now, do you get a sense that, let me rephrase this. Do you get a sense of how the Republican and Democratic Party leaderships see the compromise legislation and how the general public might see it to the extent that it's possible at the moment to get a reading of the general mood?
Sure. So, Reid, when the initial framework came out from this group.
And I'm sorry, Harry Reid is
Senator Harry Reid, who's the majority leader, who's the Democratic leader in the Senate. He was supportive of just the general framework of the bill, so I think he's pretty supportive of it. Mitch McConnell, who's the Republican leader in the Senate, I think is less so. He, you know, has not come out in support of that. It's unclear how exactly he'll deal with it. And then just the party in general, the Republican Party, I think that there are some in the party who sort of are of the mind that this is something that needs to be done. Obviously, there are four Republicans in the group that put together the bill, and they view it that way. And I think that they have some allies in that, especially outside of Congress. But it's sort of unclear about how many opponents we'll have within their party. Obviously, the bill is really long. It's 844 pages, so, you know, an average person in the public is going to have various things that, you know, they might not even know about, or there are a lot of issues in there that people can have different opinions about. But broadly, polling has shown that at least allowing, you know, people who are here in the U.S. without status, allowing them to eventually become citizens, be able to, you know, become legal residents is something that's pretty popular, and a majority of people support it.
You know, I get the sense now that there are much starker differences between the parties on immigration policy now than there might have been 20 years ago. One example is that 20 or so years ago, in the early days of the Clinton administration, there was a Democratic congressman from Texas or Arizona, one of these border states, who signed on to an effort to end the constitutional guarantee of birthright citizenship. And for some reason, it's harder for me to imagine a Democrat signing on to such a position nowadays. I mean, am I right?
Oh, absolutely. I think that it would be shocking. It would be huge news if a Democrat signed on to something like that. Republicans still do. I mean, it's not really the majority opinion at all, but there's legislation in the House that gets introduced each session to take that away. But I think definitely the Democratic Party has come around a lot to where it's not as acceptable to be in opposition to this kind of immigration reform.
Now, this being said, one of the people playing a key role in the current debate, of course, is Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio, who is of Cuban descent. And of course, there are all sorts of speculation that he will, in fact, be running for national office Sunday sooner rather than later. What does this bill mean for him?
I think it's really important. It's a huge, you know, it's a huge political risk. He's kind of going out on a limb. You know, obviously, they've thought about the politics of it, and they must think it's a good idea politically if they're going ahead and doing it, but it's going to be something that he's going to get a lot of criticism for. He's already facing a lot of people who kind of have these conspiracy theories about it from the right, and who think that he is pushing for amnesty, which is sort of the bad word that's given to anything that, you know, is seen as too lenient on illegal immigration. And so there's, you know, there's risks for him, but I think he also sees this upside in people who are concerned that the Republican Party isn't able to appeal to Latino voters, partially because of immigration. And so he's seen as this person that not only is Latino, but also is able to sort of speak in a way that speaks better to Latino voters and, you know, maybe can fix that problem through supporting immigration.
And in fact, he is very, very visible for a first-term senator because, I mean, he doesn't even have, you know, 3 full years in the U.S. Senate, and already he has his name attached to a major piece of legislation. Yep. I mean, it's pretty extraordinary, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, not only that, not only having his name attached, he's been the primary spokesman for it, sort of from the Republicans to conservative talk radio. He's gone on a ton of radio shows. He's gone on a lot of TV programs, and he's really been public about kind of shooting down these myths about the policy. So kind of he's the person that's been put out to tamp down this conservative criticism. So he's very, very public in the whole thing. It's a, you know, huge responsibility to take on for this bill. And so I think that it is very significant for his career.
Well, in fact, and let me go on a slight tangent here, talk about Rubio less in terms of the immigration debate, but about his general, you know, presence in the U.S. Congress. I mean, has he been able to author a lot of legislation? Has he been able to attach his name to a significant amount of legislation? I mean, he is, you know, a member of what is now the minority party in the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, I mean, he's been able to get involved in some of the bigger pushes, sort of on both sides. He, this wasn't a legislative push, but he joined the filibuster over, you know, calling for answers on drones recently, and he's been vocal about a lot of things. I think in terms of just general being vocal, he's someone that a lot of people pay attention to. So even if he's not the person putting out the legislation, everyone's pretty interested to hear what he thinks about it. He's sort of seen as somebody who can speak to this Tea Party wing of the Republican Party. And so, you know, like you said, despite the fact that he's a very, like, a relative newcomer to the Senate, he still gets a lot of play. Gets a lot of time to voice his thoughts.
Well, listen, Elise, I want to thank you. I think you're having a busy day up on the Hill today. I think you're up on the Hill today, aren't you?
I am, yeah.
Listen, lots of things to cover. I mean, it's been a very, very busy week in the U.S. Senate with the votes, as you mentioned, on gun control legislation, the immigration debate, obviously. Thank you for taking the time to speak to us for a few minutes. It's a debate we'll keep following. Hopefully, we can do it again before too long. Thanks a lot.
Definitely. Thank you.
All right. Take care. Okay, well, we had François Sue in the studio holding the fort down brilliantly and asking questions. We had Roger Muntu not just 10 minutes late, but with a Burberry shirt, the beautiful gray Burberry shirt. I mean, the man is a fashion icon.
Sound like 10 minutes late.
What can
great.
I tell you? Dude, I got to take a photo. Hold on. Take the iPhone.
Taking a picture. All right, great.
But of course,
thanks,
as it deserves.
Oh, you know what? You have to wait because I have something really good to take my picture with. All right.
Oh, great. Yeah, it goes without saying.
Gotta have that.
That's the Roger Muntu you know and love. You know, we hope you never leave, because when you do, you're going to miss us so much, and we're going to miss you so much.
That's right. She better not leave. We're keeping her.
Okay. Anyway, we had François Sue there for in the studio, Roger Muntu with us. You've been listening to ID West. I'm Robert D. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to Independence West on VOA.